Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday the 9th of December. As the rebels who toppled Bashar al-Assad move to consolidate power in Syria, we have a report from one of the country's notorious jails, where political prisoners were detained and tortured during the Assad years, and which are now being opened up. We'll also ask how Syria avoids the disasters that befell other Arab countries where long-time leaders were overthrown. The government here has announced it's pausing Syrian asylum claims. We ask how it should be dealing with the new authorities in Damascus. And we hear how Syrians who live in the UK view the changes taking place in their home country. And we have reflections from an exiled Syrian composer who was called the musician of the revolution. A day after the House of Assad was toppled like a house of cards, statues of Syria's long-time ruling dynasty have continued to meet a similar fate. That was the town of Dar Atir, just north of Damascus. Well, celebrations on the streets and consolidation of power on the airwaves, where the Islamist-led rebels who captured the Syrian capital are now firmly in charge of state television.
Statement number one from the Conquest of Damascus Operations Room. In the name of God, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. By God's will, the city of Damascus has been liberated and the tyrant Bashar al-Assad has fallen.
Well, today the process of handing over power from regime to rebels has continued in what appears to be a relatively smooth manner. Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, leader of the Islamist group HTS, which spearheaded the takeover of Damascus, met the man who served as the now exiled president's prime minister. The Syrian parliament and Bashar al-Assad's Ba'ath party have pledged allegiance to the new rulers. But not everyone shares the jubilation, as we discovered when we spoke to one woman who prefers to remain anonymous.
Unfortunately, as a woman, I'm not sure whether I will be able to continue living as I want to. I'm not sure whether I will have my freedom. Another thing, to tell you the truth, I'm not so sure that corruption will end and, you know, dictatorship will end, because they didn't give us a good example as well when they were in the opposition. Before they got some power in Idlib, they did not give good example to the Syrian people, because we heard that they were fighting over the spoils and they were fighting over the money and who would rule. And to tell you the truth, it's the first time I'm thinking of leaving the country. I have no idea where to go. I don't know. I had only my Syria. I'm losing my country.
One woman in Damascus there. Well, Syria faces many questions now, not least how to avoid submitting to the chaos and instability that subsumed other Arab countries whose rulers were toppled. And in the even shorter term, there's a question about the network of notorious prisons where tens of thousands of political detainees disappeared under the Assad dictatorships. The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher has been to one of those prisons today. I spoke to her just before we came on air and I asked her, first of all, what the atmosphere was like in Damascus the day after Assad's fall.
People are out on the streets more. There's more of a sense of what comes next. I think yesterday was dealing with what had happened. Now we're looking forward to what this all means. The shops are still closed, most of them. There's also been efforts to try to get the new dispensation, if you want to call that, up and running. So the leader of the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebel group that took over Damascus, met with the former prime minister to talk about a coordinated transfer of power. You've also had meetings of this group, the HTS. Representatives met with Christian and minority communities to try once again to reassure them that they would be protected, even though this is an Islamist group that is going to be taking over the capital and parts of the country. So there's been this a sense of trying to move things forward with steps that deal with governance and with a peaceful transfer of power. That's the message being sent at the moment.
At the same time, though, the past is there very much at the forefront of the transformation. And you've been to somewhere where the horrors of the recent few years are very much in evidence.
Yes, that really struck me, actually, that the brutal legacy of the Assad regime is there. It's not going to go away, and it's something that has to be dealt with by many people who've been affected by it before they move on into whatever is coming next. So I was at the Saidnaya prison, which is just outside Damascus, one of the most notorious prisons. Thousands of opposition figures were sent there, many of them tortured and executed, according to widespread documentation. And that was opened just in the last 48 hours, I think, when the rebels came into Damascus. They opened up the prison and many people were freed. But there's a suspicion, a belief that there might be more there, that there are hidden cells underground, that there's an underground network of cells and that people are still in them. So when I went there, there were many, many people. There are hundreds, maybe thousands. They were the family members who've been searching the prisons for people who've been missing for many years, coming to see if something might turn up here. And we got into the prison and looked at some of the efforts to try to find openings to whatever kind of prison network might exist underneath the regular one. People are going to press this issue. People are going to try to get resolution on this issue of where their loved ones have gone and what has happened to them. I'm about 30 kilometres outside of Damascus by one of the main prison complexes. It's called Said Naya. And I can see two prisons in the distance on a hill. The one to the right is the main prison. There, HTS freed the inmates already. The one to the left is called the Red Prison. And there, it's believed that some prisoners are still locked in cells underground. And there is a stream of people walking up the hill towards it.
Said Naya is a symbol for some of the darkest abuses of Bashar al-Assad's rule. Thousands of opposition supporters were tortured and killed here. Now there's a stampede of family members taking the chance of finding those still missing. Everyone has a desperate story to tell of loved ones jailed for years. Mundir Tarki is looking for his brother-in-law.
I know my experience with the Sinwar regime since more than 13 years. I've lost a lot of my friends in prisons, but I think we could. I don't know. We pray for that. We try. We are trying to find him in and everywhere. We're asking everyone. We came to here, like everyone.
Call me the wounded mother, says this woman, because of the children she's lost. May God take revenge on Bashar.
We're climbing the hill now to reach the top where the prisons are, joining that long stream of people who are also doing the same, wanting to find out if the search efforts in the prison are going to turn up any people still locked up there.
Just days ago, rebels freed thousands of prisoners here on their march to Damascus, but many believe others are still trapped in underground cells. The Syrian civil defense group, the White Helmets, has joined the search. We spoke with one of its volunteers.
Based on the information we've gathered, we believe there's a network of cells with prisoners beneath the jail, but we haven't yet been able to find the entrance. We don't have any details on how many people are underground, but we were informed of this by others.
We just pressed into the prison. We came in a real crush because there was this sudden belief that they had found the entrance to the underground prison. But it looks like it's been a false alarm.
They're searching the bowels of the prison, looking for tunnels that lead to hidden cells, pounding away at the earthen floor. Frantic efforts to break through to anyone who might still be alive. Elsewhere, men sift through a litter of documents for any evidence of their loved ones or clues to the underground prison. Many are convinced it exists, but there are some doubts, including from a prisoner support group. Outside, an older woman with a steady gaze, Umm al-Abid, tells me she's looking for her son. She used to visit him in prison, but then he was moved. After the past 2 weeks, Syria has entered a new era, but she is still caught in the dark grip of the old one.
Our priority is our sons, who are the future of this country. Do you believe that we, the elderly, can do much now? We want our boys back. We want our country back, too.
How can this country move forward without dealing with the horrors of its past?
Barbara Plet-Usher reporting there from and in and around Damascus. Well, let's pick up on her final thought there about how Syria deals with its oppressive pass as it tries to move towards what it hopes will be a brighter, freer future? How does it avoid repeating the post-revolutionary mistakes of other Arab countries, such as Iraq, where the US-led coalition's policy of de-Baathification after the toppling of Saddam Hussein, that was disqualifying all members of the ruling Ba'ath Party from office, that led to the collapse of the state and it created the conditions for a long and deadly insurgency? Well, Muaz Mustafa is executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force. It's a US-based organization that was formed to respond to the Assad regime's suppression of dissent and to push for accountability for war crimes. I spoke to him shortly after he had met the US National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, today, and I asked him what he made of those images of freed political prisoners.
It has not been surprising at all. It has just been confirming what we've been screaming at the world, screaming to the world that there are concentration camps, gulags, dungeons where little babies are tortured to death, where people, men, women, children, elderly, don't even see the light and only hear the screams of torture and then their own screams of torture. And so seeing these prisons liberated, these concentration camps liberated, it is the most wonderful feeling in the world, yet so heartbreaking in the sense that there are still rooms and dungeons underground we're trying to open up, but there aren't international rescue teams helping us. As said, was an equal opportunity torturer of humanity.
Of course, he had a network that carried out what happened in those prisons. What should happen to them now?
Those that ordered the torture, those that ran these jails, then ran away, locked the keys and ran away, they need to be held accountable. The ICC has been closed its doors for us as much as we tried. They wouldn't give even an arrest warrant for an Assad official or Assad himself. And so now we need the help of the international community, those that can help us with the preservation of documents, those that can help us with how to go about starting a judicial system that is going to be important for a civil court in Syria that then these war criminals can be held accountable. There are no revenge, anything. It's not like de-Baathification. The prime minister of the Assad regime is still on the ground working with the new government. The war criminals, with the blood of children on their hands, they will stand before a court of law when they are arrested, just like Bashar al-Assad will be arrested one day.
Well, you have raised what I wanted to raise, which was de-Baathification. What happened in Iraq is seen as a blueprint for how not to do things. How do Syrians now go about creating a new state without, I guess, throwing everything out? Is it possible that some of those who have been part, however tangentially, of the Assad regime do still hold some positions of responsibility in this new Syria?
First of all, the Syrian revolution was started with the Syrian people of all stripes calling for their democracy, dignity, and freedom. We do not want anything like de-Baathifications. We want to preserve our institutions and ensure their continuity. And that's what's allowing Syria to be able to, you know, deal with rebuilding a new Syria for everyone.
So the institutions can be preserved, but just with new people running them?
Not necessarily. You know, if there are, like I said, you know, if you're a jailer or if you're the head of an intelligence branch or anything, you weren't running anything but a human slaughterhouse. So you need to face accountability. But if you worked in the Ministry of Information, now you're doing it on behalf of a free Syria than on behalf of a tyrant. And the fact that you were doing it on behalf of a tyrant before is because they would have killed your whole family if you didn't. So we understand, we're Syrians. We all lived through this. People that worked in the Ministry of Agriculture, I don't care even if their political leanings went for Bashar al-Assad, as long as they're there to help run, you know, farms in Deir ez-Zor and they're great at it, then they should remain.
You say the key thing is no revenge in any form. How is that guaranteed, you think? What's the best way to ensure that there is not a cycle of revenge, given just what the Assad regime has carried out and how it's affected so many people?
The way to prevent revenge is to ensure that there is justice and accountability. But what's really prevented revenge is the fact that the Syrian people have always loved each other. We've been living for the last 60 whatever years under Bashar al-Assad and his father's administrations. And what it did was to pit different sects against each other. each other. But in fact, Syria isn't like that. For thousands of years, all these, you know, communities, this beautiful mosaic, has lived together. That's what we're seeing happen again.
And what of Assad and his family now in Russia? Are they beyond, do you think, the reach of courts?
Nobody is beyond the reach of justice in courts. It's a matter of time.
Moaz Mostafa, Executive Director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force, speaking to me from Washington, D.C. Now, on the day when Rachel Reeves became the first UK Chancellor since Britain left the EU to attend a meeting of Eurogroup finance ministers in Brussels, part of Keir Starmer's wider UK-EU reset, the government announced it was mirroring the European approach in a different area. Germany, France and Italy are among those who have paused asylum claims by Syrians, while the government in Austria is going further and looking at repatriation. This afternoon, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, gave this update.
We know that the situation in Syria is moving extremely fast after the fall of the Assad regime. We have seen some people returning to Syria, but we also have a very fast-moving situation that we need to closely monitor. And that is why, like Germany, like France and like other countries, we have paused asylum decisions on cases from Syria while the Home Office reviews and monitors the current situation.
We'll come back to what our government's response should be to this moving situation. But first, I've been speaking to Susan Fratzke. She's a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute in Germany. And she told me why European governments were taking these steps.
Asylum claims and grants of refugee status are based on someone's fear to return to a country due to particular circumstances. And if those circumstances change, then the country who is evaluating the application for asylum needs to revise how they are then deciding on those cases. So right now they're waiting to see what happens, and then they'll make a determination on whether or how to grant refugee status going forward.
And when something like this happens, the overthrow of a regime, is this normal procedure?
For the moment, this is largely normal procedure. So they'll be updating the special guidance that they use for asylum officers to decide claims, and they'll be determining what recommendations they'll be making for these cases going forward.
Right. But at least one country, Austria, has held out the possibility it could go further than pausing or not accepting new claims and actually repatriate some of those already in the country. Would that be different to something that has been seen before?
Yes, so countries do have the right to withdraw refugee status from individuals who have it if conditions in the home country change. But normally, the countries are encouraged to be fairly measured in the use of that right. What Austria has done now has asked its government to prepare what it's calling a return program. It's not clear yet exactly what that means. There's a number of different ways they could do it. They could, for example, simply offer packages of assistance to encourage individuals to return on their own. They could go as far as revoking refugee status and grounds for protection. But if conditions simply aren't stable enough, but they aren't specifically afraid of persecution themselves, they may still not be able to be returned legally.
This all comes at a time when asylum and immigration generally is a very hot topic across the EU, in the UK as well. Is there a danger that the Syrian situation gets dragged into a broader political set of negotiations?
Yes, I think that's a very real danger. Syrians have been one of the largest nationalities claiming asylum in Europe over the last several years, and countries like Germany and Austria have really been feeling under pressure by the number of claims that they've been receiving. This is, you know, coming on top of, as well, hosting several million Ukrainians. So countries were already very keen to reduce the number of asylum applications that they've been receiving, and in particular, many of them were targeting Syrians. So the risk here, I think, is that countries may politically want to move faster on either changing the way that they are deciding on asylum applications or even beginning to encourage people to return home or revoking that status.
And what about non-EU countries? What about Syria's neighbours, who, of course, have the bulk of the refugees who've left the country?
Yes, I think there is a risk there that the ultimate fate of the Syrians who are in neighboring countries like Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan also becomes wrapped up in political circumstances on the ground. It's important to recognize that in all three of those countries, most Syrians do not, in fact, have refugee status. Lebanon and Jordan aren't parties to the international law that governs refugee status. And in Turkey, Syrians have been given a temporary protected status, not refugee status. In Turkey, I imagine that there will be quite a lot of pressure to encourage Syrians to return home. In Jordan, the government will likely negotiate with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who provides protection for Syrians there, to figure out exactly the conditions under which Syrians will go home. And in Lebanon, the situation is quite unstable.
That was Susan Fratzke with the Migration Policy Institute. Well, as well as the question of Syrian asylum seekers, Western countries are weighing up how to deal with those who are now in control of Damascus. They come from an Islamist group, HDS, which is prescribed as a terrorist organization in many Western countries. In the last hour or so, France and Germany have said they are conditionally ready to cooperate with the new Syrian leaders. And earlier today, Keir Starmer was asked whether he would be taking a swift decision about the status of HTS.
No decision is pending at all on this. It is far too early. At the moment, the focus has to be on talking to our allies, making sure that this is an opportunity for Syria, and therefore we have to work to make sure that it's a peaceful opportunity.
Well, we can speak now to Emily Thornbury, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Labour MP for Islington South and Finsbury. Good evening, Emily.
Good evening.
Can we start with the question of the asylum seekers and those applications being paused? Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I mean, it's this, isn't it? If someone arrives from Syria and they're saying they're fleeing the Assad regime or they've been persecuted by the Assad regime, at the moment it's difficult to make a decision about that because everything is in so much flux. So all that's being said is that it's being paused whilst things shake down and it's difficult to work out. Yeah, I mean, you might get, I suppose, if there was a, let's take it away from Syria, but if you have a country where there is a change of regime, you might get, you know, asylum seekers from one side and then the regime falls and then you might get asylum seekers from the other side. So, I mean, everything is chaotic. And so it's quite difficult in those circumstances to make such important decisions that it needs to be made right. And there'll be advice to those who are making the decisions. And that's a country file. And that needs to be updated depending on what happens. You know,
could Britain, though, go further than pausing it? Shadow Justice Secretary Robert Jenrick has called on ministers to immediately begin deporting Syrian asylum seekers in the wake of Assad's departure.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that's a kind of classic shooting from the hip from Robert Jenrick. I'm afraid it isn't thought through. It isn't sensible. And of course, we wouldn't do that.
The Austrians are considering it.
Yeah, well, I don't imagine. Well, I certainly wouldn't. I certainly would hope that the British government would not be considering that. We need to find out what is happening in Syria, and the Syrians don't even know yet. So let's give this a bit of time and work out what is going to happen next in Syria.
Well, apropos that, we know who at the moment is in control, and it's people from this organisation, HTS, which is prescribed as a terrorist organisation. Now, earlier today on the Today programme, Pat McFadden suggested that a decision about whether to reconsider that designation should come quickly. But the Prime Minister is sounding a bit more cautious on that. He's saying, no, we're going to take our time. What do you think?
So I think it isn't just about HTS. Let's... In case any of your listeners haven't heard yet, I mean, HTS is an organisation that historically was linked to Al-Qaeda. Its leader spent time in jail in Iraq. He has a price on his head himself. So when in charge of Idlib, it was there were a number of very serious allegations made by the United Nations about breaches of human rights. So there is concern that whatever he may say or whatever they may say, their actions say something else. So that's HTS. But there are other armed groups as well. So there are armed groups of Kurds. There are others coming up from the south. You know, so it's quite difficult at the moment to know for sure kind of where we will be in a week's time.
I suppose the question is, where are we taking our lead from at the moment? Are you looking, should we be, our government be looking at the fact that the Syrian parliament and those who were loyal to the Assad regime seem to be doing deals with the new people in charge and make our decisions accordingly? Or how are those decisions taken in Britain's interests?
So I think that it is in everybody's interest for there to be an inclusive interim government that is able to work towards a more lasting peace that is one which will respect the rights of minorities, respect the rights of women. We're not going on a blank piece of paper. I mean, there have been Syrians working on this under the auspices of the United Nations for many years, drafting constitutions and new laws. This is the sort of thing that really should have some Syrian lead in it. And just because, you know, one group got to the television station before anyone else, we shouldn't necessarily assume that they're the ones who will be in power in a year's time.
Emily Thornberry, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Thanks very much indeed. A couple of other headlines tonight. A court in the United States has ruled that three of Rupert Murdoch's adult children will retain control of his media empire when he dies, after he tried to remove their voting powers from the trust he set up and to give full control to his eldest son, Lachlan. And the leader of Edinburgh City Council, Cammie Day, has resigned 2 days after being suspended by Scottish Labour, pending the outcome of a police investigation into allegations of inappropriate behaviour. Now, there's been a major update in the investigation into the killing of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, who was shot dead outside the Hilton Hotel in New York last week in what police called a brazen targeted attack. Police have now arrested a 26-year-old computer science graduate in connection with the shooting. And I got more details from our North America reporter, Neda Taufik.
After a 5-day manhunt, police believe they have their suspect. They have identified a man who was spotted by an employee at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Now, that is a town more than a 4 hours drive outside of New York. And that man was Luigi Mangione. The employee actually felt that he resembled those widely circulated images of the suspected gunman and alerted local authorities. And so police say that the responding officers questioned Mangione, that he was acting suspiciously, and that when they searched him, he had multiple fraudulent IDs. He had a weapon that was consistent with the one used to kill Brian Thompson, that he had a mask and clothing consistent with what the suspected gunman wore, as well as a 3-page handwritten manifesto that showed ill will towards corporate America. So New York officials pretty confident that they have their suspect, though he hasn't been charged yet with anything.
And that final detail, perhaps the most intriguing in many ways, the manifesto.
Absolutely. I mean, look, since the beginning of this investigation, a key question was what was the motive in this very brazen and targeted killing in Midtown, right by Rockefeller Center, block south of Central Park, that very graphic video going across the globe. And there were kind of hints here and there, not least shell casings that were found on the scene that had words that kind of really reflected many said tactics used by insurance companies to deny medical claims. Of course, Brian Thompson himself, the CEO of one of the largest insurers, which has been accused by politicians, regulators of systematically denying people's claims far more than other insurers, for example. And so this handwritten manifesto just adds to this picture, this puzzle that investigators are building to try to understand the motive. But the NYPD is now on the scene in Altoona, Pennsylvania as well, and they are going to be questioning Luigi Mangione to see what else they can reveal.
The BBC's Neda Taufik in New York. Well as yesterday's scenes of jubilation from inside Syria, members of the Syrian diaspora across the world celebrated the end of the Assad era. But what are their feelings today now that initial euphoria has slightly died down and a rebel group that was once affiliated with Al-Qaeda seems to hold the reins of power? Well, earlier today, I popped down to Uxbridge Road in West London to hear from some Syrians who live in this country. My first stop was the I Am Zaman restaurant, where I met a man who grew up in Damascus, but who has lived here almost as long as the Assad family held on to power.
My name is Muhammad Haytham Yasir. I was a chef for almost 40 years. I arrived to this country in 1977. Maybe some of you hasn't been even born.
So when you left Syria, it was a father, Hafez, who was ruling the country.
The main tyrant, the main one.
So we were just given a very tasty, lovely, sweet baklava. Pastry.
That's the baklava.
It's very nice. And sweets for a sweet day for you?
Exactly. You can't imagine. You've been under... The worst occupation is when you are occupied by your own people.
People are looking at what has happened. It's been so quick, this end to the Assad regime, and they are wondering about what comes next and who the people are that are going to be in power. What are your thoughts about what's going to come next?
My funny thought is we waited 54 years to get rid of this tyrant. At least give us 50 days to get ourselves together. I am sure there will be silly people going this, stealing this, la la, but it will be better, 100%.
You just come down the road, and the supermarket here called Damask Gate, it's got a wide variety of fruit and veg outside. Inside, some rather luscious smelling Syrian delicacies. There's falafel, some lovely olives there as well. And managing director, also originally from Damascus, is called Maha.
We are happy what's happened because we finished long term of dictator regime. But we have some concern about the people who come to power now.
You say you're concerned. Are you worried about who has led these troops that have come into Damascus? Is that your concern?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
because he is still considered a terrorist in the West.
But for us, they are not terrorists. They are part of the population. I have some people here working to the company. They are planning to go back after maybe 2 or 3 months till the thing settle in there.
Are any of them in the shop now?
One of them, he didn't turn up today because one of his brother was a prisoner there.
So he's helping the family to look?
Yeah.
We did meet one young Syrian working there. He's called Ayman. He said he arrived in Britain 2 years ago and his asylum claim is still being processed. With Maha's help translating, and before the government announced it was pausing Syrian asylum claims, I asked him whether he was worried that something like that might happen.
No. He said, no, it's okay. We hope Syria will be better and it doesn't matter if it's affect his case or not. Yeah, because at the end he wants to go back. He's afraid to be there like a war, a game, like a civil war.
Because you have direct experience. Your brother died in the civil war, is that correct?
Yeah, he said his brother was died in the prison, and he hopes so that's it's gonna be okay. Civil war gonna happen in there again. So he's waiting.
And that was Syrian shop worker Ayman speaking to me alongside his boss and for today at least his translator Maha. Well, a new Syria is about to be built, that much we know. What we don't know, of course, is how that's going to play out. The emigre Syrian composer Malek Jandali moved to the United States in the 1990s, where he became known as the musician of the revolution for his response to the repression of protesters who took part in the 2011 uprising in his home country. He channeled much of his creativity into providing a soundtrack for the desire for change in Syria. And now that change has come. And Malek has been speaking to my colleague, Tim Franks.
What we are witnessing today are truly historical moments. The world and humanity today is in a much better place without such a brutal, ruthless dictator. The Syrian people are for the first time free, celebrating their struggle. You know, they paid a very a heavy price for their freedom and dignity. Today, what we are witnessing is a true symphony for peace. People are in the streets chanting as they did in 2012. Chanting for freedom, for peace, and for their country. Syria is 7,000 plus years old. We are the cradle of civilizations. We always embraced all religions throughout history. We have one of the oldest communities in the world that speak the Aramaic language of Jesus Christ. We have one of the oldest synagogue in Aleppo. And who destroyed these historical UNESCO monuments? The brutal dictator. He is against music, against diversity, against humanity, against children, against justice and freedom and human rights. So fear is legitimate. However, in the last few days, the Syrian people have proven when they returned to their homes and villages, you know, with minimum violence and showing the world that we are a true revolution for dignity, for freedom, and most importantly, for peace in our world.
Syria does have a civilization that stretches back thousands of years, because a lot of what has been said about Assad and the Assad family's rule over the last 50 plus years is that they've so much of modern Syria has been under their brutal grip. But actually, of course, Syria's entire history stretches back vastly further into time.
In my humble opinion, this brutal dictator destroyed the culture of Syria through a very dirty strategy to divide people based on sectarian, based on, evil.
You forged your reputation partly as somebody who provided the soundtrack for protest, for a brief uprising, but then to sort of give people succor those awful years when any type of protest was so brutally repressed. Do you imagine that you will be taking your music in person to Syria at some point?
Absolutely. I dream to perform my symphonies at the Opera House, in the streets of Homs, where many of my family members and friends and many people who sacrificed their lives and they were killed. I will go back to give them a voice through the elegant symphonic music to tell the world that we are part of you.
The emigre Syrian composer Malik Jandali speaking to Tim Franks there. Our closing headline tonight. The leader of the main Islamist rebel group in Syria has met the former prime minister to coordinate the transfer of power a day after President Assad fled to Russia. There are reports that Israeli air warplanes have carried out dozens of strikes across Syria to try to stop chemical weapons from falling into the hands of extremists. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara Sami. I'm back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone here, good night.